Welcome to Second Opinion, interactive case-based discussions focused on management of metastatic prostate cancer and highlights of a CME satellite meeting held at the GU Cancer Symposium on January 31st in San Francisco. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. During our meeting, the five faculty members reacted to cases presented on video by a number of community-based general medical oncologists. And for this program, I met after the symposium with two of the faculty, Drs. Thomas Baer and Oliver Sartor, to go back over the cases we discussed and many audience questions submitted by PDAs. To begin, Dr. Baer talks about one of the cases we discussed, a 53-year-old man who initially presented 4 years previously with a supraclavicular node and widespread prostate cancer. The initial PSA was over 5,000, and the patient was managed with androgen deprivation therapy and did well for 2 years, but then had disease progression and received 10 cycles of docetaxel, but again had disease progression. At that point, the patient was asymptomatic, and Dr. Baer discussed the treatment options we reviewed in the symposium.
So in this patient, I would be thinking about one of the new second-line androgen signaling inhibitors, enzalutamide or abiraterone. Those drugs have both now been shown to be effective after chemotherapy and prior to chemotherapy as well. For abiraterone a little earlier, for enzalutamide, just presented at a scientific meeting in February of this year. And these agents produce impressive response rates, delay disease progression, extend survival, and really produce benefit across all the major endpoints. So they're very attractive agents to consider. Whether one chooses enzalutamide or abiraterone in this situation is, you know, we really have no scientific data that allow us to compare those two agents. So I think either agent would be appropriate, and we might consider some second-order issues in making that choice. Abiraterone requires prednisone for some patients, particularly diabetics. That may be a complicating factor. Enzalutamide is contraindicated in patients with a history of seizures. So, you know, there are these sort of second-order issues that might lead one to choose one agent or the other. I might also be thinking about a bisphosphonate with widespread metastases and castration-resistant disease. Supportive therapy aimed at reducing the risk of skeletal complications would also be considered.
So I want to follow up in terms of what happened with this patient, but first you mentioned a data presented in February, and you were actually the one who presented that data. I think it was the day before we actually had this meeting, the so-called PREVAIL trial. Can you talk about what you presented, what the trial looked at, and what it found?
Sure. So the PREVAIL trial was a global placebo-controlled randomized trial of enzalutamide or placebo in men with metastatic prostate cancer that had progressed on primary hormonal therapy with or without bicalutamide, but that hadn't yet been treated with chemotherapy. We knew previously that enzalutamide extended survival and improved progression-free survival after chemotherapy. This was the trial that moved the drug earlier into the pre-chemotherapy setting. There were 1,717 patients enrolled, and the trial was stopped early as a result of a positive finding for both co-primary endpoints of overall survival and radiographic progression-free survival. So the risk of death was reduced by 29%. The risk of disease progression or death, that's the combined definition for radiographic progression-free survival, was reduced by 81%. The response rates by PSA, by measurable disease, were very impressive. The PSA response rate was 78%. Measurable disease response rate was 59%. There was evidence of a delay in the deterioration of quality of life. So all in all, the drug was clearly active. The safety profile was quite good. 6% of patients discontinued treatment for a side effect in both arms, placebo and enzalutamide. There was no difference in that regard. There were only 2 seizures on the study out of 1,700 patients, and it turned out that there was 1 seizure in the placebo group and 1 seizure in the enzalutamide group. So that concern didn't prove to be a significant issue in the study. So on the whole, a clear advantage with regard to survival and disease progression with an oral drug with a reasonable safety profile. So a very encouraging study.
So a few questions that were submitted from the audience when you reviewed these data. 1, what type of seizures are seen with enzalutamide?
You know, these are, generally speaking, generalized seizures, but frankly, there are so few cases that I'm not sure that we have, you know, a large database to really declare that it's one or the other. In the AFFIRM study, which was the post-chemotherapy study, if memory serves, it was about 6 patients. There were 2 patients here. I think there were 3 patients in the phase 1-2 study. So we have a grand total of a dozen or so patients across 3 studies that have experienced seizures. Many of them had either a history of seizures or some other predisposing factor, up to and including one patient who got overdosed with IV lidocaine at the time. So not enough really to have a clear pattern, but it was very nice to see that out of 1,700 patients in this study, only 2 had seizures. And in point of fact, both of these patients had a prior history of seizures, which should have excluded them from the study, but that was not known to the investigators at the time. So if you look at the remaining patients who didn't have a history of seizures, we didn't see a single case.
Another related question, do you think dural-based meds are a reason not to use enzalutamide?
That's a good question. I don't know that I have a good answer for that. That was not an exclusion in this study. So I think a straightforward answer is probably not a reason to exclude the use of the drug. But it would also be fair to say that we haven't looked at that question yet. And that's a good question that as we analyze the data from the PREVAIL study, I'm going to be interested in seeing whether we can get at that question and get you a real answer based on data.
So another question from the audience, when do you discontinue enzalutamide due to toxicity? And that kind of ties into the case itself, because this same patient that we're talking about right now did receive enzalutamide after the docetaxel, had a good response. The problem with this patient was that the patient had breast tenderness. And it was really bothering the patient a lot to the point that the physician actually reduced the dose down to 120 milligrams, and the patient's been much better on that and is doing totally fine. But what about this issue of side effects? When do you discontinue the drug? And what do you think about this idea of dose modification as it was done in this case?
Well, I think in the study, we saw 6% of patients stop therapy for a side effect. And incidentally, it was the same number for placebo and enzalutamide. So that kind of gives us a base idea of how often a toxicity was severe enough to do that. It may be that outside of a study, that number would be a little higher. You know, in studies, people tend to really stick with the regimen, and the real world is not always exactly like that. But it's a minority of patients. I feel quite comfortable dose-reducing enzalutamide, in part because we had the opportunity to be a part of the phase 1 and 2 program. So we've worked with this drug from the very beginning. And I remember very well that even at 30 milligrams, we were seeing significant activity in hormone-resistant prostate cancer patients. I'm not advocating that we dose reduce to that low a level, but we saw activity really at every dose level. So going down to 120 or maybe even 80 milligrams, if a side effect requires it, doesn't frighten me at all.
So there's a related question from the audience. Do you think you can stop leuprolide when you're giving enzalutamide and the patient is stable?
We don't have any data on that at all. We have this longstanding standard of continuing the LHRH agonist therapy, in part because, remember, it replaced orchiectomy, which is a permanent sort of therapy. So to keep the field level, we've taken the view that LHRH agonist therapy should be continued. And there have been some retrospective analyses in a past era without these potent new agents that have suggested that continued suppression of androgen levels is important. In this new era of enzalutamide or even abiraterone, frankly, we don't have any data and we don't know. The proper answer would be yes, we should continue them because that is how this has been studied. A practical approach might be to follow testosterone levels. Many of these patients, as you know, if they've been on LHRH agonist for a long time and you stop the therapy, they don't actually recover testosterone production. So you may be able to take a break from those injections, save the patient the trouble and the cost, and check testosterone levels periodically and may be surprised to find that they remain low despite the absence of therapy. You know, if testosterone begins to rise on enzalutamide, we're really beyond what the data say, so I don't really have a data-driven recommendation on that.
So a lot of questions about abiraterone also, and certainly the most common one, I think it's the most common one we got in general, was the issue of using the second new hormonal therapy after the first. So sequence in terms of what do you see in a patient who's, let's say, responded to abiraterone and then gets enzalutamide? What do you see in a patient who doesn't respond too well to the second one? What about the reverse sequence? What about the combination?
Yeah, unfortunately, I've seen it all. I wish there was an easy rule of thumb, and it would make sense maybe that patients who've responded well to one might respond well to the other, because that would suggest that they're hormonally dependent. But I've also seen patients who didn't respond at all to one agent and responded to the other, and I've seen it in both sequences. So far, you know, if you look at the data that we see and the sum total of our experience, I think what one can say is that the response rates and the response durations in the second line setting for either drug following the other are lower than upfront. You know, folks have reported response rates on the order of 30% or 25% by PSA, as opposed to 50, 60, 70% upfront. The data that we have so far are small, typically observational reports from individual institutions, 20, 30, 40 patients, and that's kind of what they're reporting. What I'm hoping to see down the line is that we'll get some robust data along with some biomarkers that might help us distinguish between patients who are going to benefit from a particular sequence from another. You know, perhaps if we sequence the androgen receptor or if we measure androgen levels in the blood, we can get smarter about this. But I don't have any data today to help the practicing physician with that decision. On the combination front, studies are just beginning, and we haven't been using the combination outside of a clinical trial. Really don't know whether that's an advantage. Could it be a disadvantage in some way? I think until the studies are done, I'm reluctant to go that far beyond what the data support.
Another question, quote, we use hydrocortisone with ketoconazole. Why not with abiraterone, maybe less steroid toxicity?
Probably could. The data have been with prednisone. I would say that in our hands, and I think in the hands of many other folks who I've talked to, we've been very comfortable reducing the dose of prednisone if there's any toxicity. So going down from 5 BID to a total of 7.5 or even 5 milligrams a day in somebody who's beginning to develop facial swelling or has blood sugar control issues is something we do routinely. We monitor the blood pressure and potassium. And in general, I've not had much trouble reducing the dose of prednisone. So that's been the approach that I've taken to dealing with this question.
In terms of both of these agents, in terms of clinical trial and where we're heading, what is being thought about, what is being done, and particularly what about the issue of PSA-only disease?
So there are studies looking at these agents in castration-resistant PSA-only disease. So this is the setting where patients started on hormonal therapy, maybe for a rising PSA, or maybe as an adjuvant treatment to radiation, now have a rising PSA negative scans. Both enzalutamide and also ARN-509, which is an investigational agent that's another androgen receptor blocker, are being studied in that way. I think the field is looking at moving these drugs earlier and earlier, where we have a clinical trial we're interested in that introduces enzalutamide into the adjuvant setting with radiation. So I think you're going to see these drugs in every setting that hormonal therapy is currently used. I think you're going to see the question of combination answered. It's an important question. I think we're also going to, beyond that, begin to look at what other combinations make sense. You know, right now, we're focused on the hormonal axis, but maybe combinations with conventional drugs like chemotherapy or even radium, but also with biologics. We've gone through a whole generation of studies that tried to combine biologic agents with chemotherapy in prostate cancer. We've not seen a lot of success there, but now we have a new backbone, an abiraterone and enzalutamide, that we can build on, and we may be able to be a little bit smarter about it than we have been in the past.
Now, these trials that are looking at these agents earlier, all of them are with an LHRH agonist?
I think that there is a handful that are looking at enzalutamide monotherapy, kind of like we once tried bicalutamide monotherapy, but the majority of them are in combination with an LHRH agonist.
Yeah, I really wondered about that because, again, thinking back to that bicalutamide example, and I always used to kind of think about tamoxifen in a weird way, it kind of reminded me of it. in that, you know, actually tamoxifen, you see elevation in premenopausal women in the serum estrogen level, and yet these people respond. Do we really know that you need an LHRH agonist to use enzalutamide?
We do not. What we do know is that bicalutamide as a single agent therapy didn't quite make it and is probably a little bit inferior to LHRH agonist-based hormonal therapy. Bicalutamide is also not as potent as enzalutamide. So I think the question of whether you need it or not is one that I'd like to see answered. We do know that antiandrogen monotherapy with bicalutamide has a different side effect profile. As we already talked, there's a higher risk of breast issues, but there's a lower risk of other things. There's less bone loss. There's some preservation of sexual function and libido. So monotherapy with an androgen receptor blocker is an attractive concept, at least from a quality of life standpoint, that I'd like to see us explore.
So you were talking about the patient who has castrate-resistant PSA-only disease. Any situations where you would use either enzalutamide or abiraterone outside of a trial? You know, you've got a younger patient very rapidly dividing PSA with progression on LHRH agonist. Seems like it'd be very tempting.
It would be very tempting. I think, you know, biologically and clinically, it makes perfect sense. There are issues with reimbursement, and of course, the data aren't there yet. But, you know, all clinicians have to find a boundary to which they're willing to extrapolate the data. It's easy for us to be dogmatic, but when you get into the trenches and take care of patients, we realize that the majority of patients we see didn't quite fit into a study that's been done. So if you have an asymptomatic or minimally symptomatic patient with metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer that's chemo-naive, that's the PREVAIL population. We have an answer for that patient. But you vary something a little bit off and a patient wasn't eligible and we're stuck trying to figure out what to do as physicians for an individual patient. So for me, the scenario you describe of a patient who may not have visible metastases yet but has every indication of impending metastatic disease, personally, I would feel comfortable clinically recommending enzalutamide even in the absence of clear data. But I do want to acknowledge that there's not an indication there. It's not data-driven yet, and there may be issues with getting the drug reimbursed.
So we had this submitted from the audience. I thought this is very interesting. Somebody who's staying pretty up to date, including press releases. 53-year-old man, 10-month response to LHRH therapy, just completed cipuleucel T, and the PSA is rising from a nadir or two. Now it's 15. The question continues, I was considering enzalutamide next. However, with the CHARTED data, should I use docetaxel? The patient's asymptomatic with bone-only mets.
So CHARTED is a study where 6 cycles of docetaxel were added to hormonal therapy upfront in metastatic disease. And the results of that study have not been reported yet. We're expecting a presentation at ASCO later this spring, early summer. But there was a press release from the National Cancer Institute that indicated that patients with extensive metastatic disease derived a survival advantage from the early introduction of chemotherapy. I would be cautious about press releases. There are a lot of questions about these results. A simple question, for example, and we've talked about this already in a different way earlier in this conversation, is the fact that many patients don't end up getting chemotherapy ever, even though it extends survival and it's indicated. So could CHARTED be a way where 100% of the patients get chemotherapy up front because the study requires that? And what happened with the other arm? Did they all get their chemotherapy later? If they did, that's clear evidence that early chemotherapy makes a difference. But if, as is commonly seen, a significant proportion of those patients who were randomly assigned to hormonal therapy alone never got chemotherapy, then I have some questions about that result. So I really want to see the data before I incorporate CHARTED results into my practice. In this particular patient, you know, it's a difficult call. The patient's already gotten hormonal therapy for, sounds like, about a year. So they're really not in that CHARTED space of newly diagnosed metastatic cancer just starting hormone therapy. I would probably be tempted to use enzalutamide or abiraterone in that setting first and save chemotherapy for later. But I would fully acknowledge that either approach would be appropriate. There's data that supports both, and I don't think we can know for sure what's in this patient's best interest a priori.
You know, this patient received Cipuleucel T, which is another thing that we chatted about during the symposium. I'm curious where you are today, now that we have these two new hormonal agents that are so effective. I'm not even quite sure where the average doc in practice is in terms of sequencing, in particular, in what situations you use Cipuleucel T, and in what situations, as in this patient, once the patient's had it, do you decide, okay, I need to use something else?
Well, you know, I think Cipuleucel T has been shown to extend survival by a median of around 4 months. In the asymptomatic or nearly asymptomatic metastatic setting, generally prior to chemotherapy, although there was a small percentage of patients who were chemotherapy pretreated that participated in the trial, those results are from a bit of a different era. None of those patients had enzalutamide or abiraterone. I'm not even sure they had cabazitaxel. Certainly didn't have radium, so it was a little bit of a different time. What the agent lacks is the ability to produce responses and slow the disease at the beginning of treatment. So when I see these patients, of course, their duration of survival is of significant concern, but so is the fact that their PSA is rising or they may be developing new metastatic lesions, and Cipuleucel T is not able to address those latter two concerns. So it is an agent that has some shortcomings in that regard. In my practice, I consider it in patients who have a longer life expectancy, who are asymptomatic, and who I think will be healthy long enough to benefit from it, and who are interested in participating with Cipuleucel T therapy. The majority of my patients in this setting end up moving directly to enzalutamide or abiraterone. When they hear about all the agents, they tend to prefer heading in that direction and are focused on the fact that these agents provide a comprehensive set of effects on the cancer, not just survival, but progression-free survival, PSA reduction, response in soft tissue disease, et cetera, et cetera. I do try to avoid using steroids within 3 months of Cipuleucel T on either end. So if I need to start a second therapy after CIP-T, I tend to go with enzalutamide rather than abiraterone if it hasn't been 3 months yet, and I tend to try to hold off on chemotherapy since prednisone is always included.
What about the delayed use of Cipuleucel T, you know, after they've received these hormones, for example?
Not a lot of data on that. I think it goes back again to whether we think the patients have really the opportunity to collect the benefit of treatment. You know, if we're talking about the average patient who's been through chemotherapy and enzalutamide and or abiraterone, the data would suggest that the median survival after all these therapies is less than a year. So that wouldn't be a setting where I'd be excited about Cipuleucel T. But there are, of course, individual patients where the disease doesn't progress that rapidly, and even though all these therapies have already been used, you can take a look at the extent and pace of disease and conclude that that patient still has a significant amount of survival in front of them. And in that setting, I'd consider CIP-T. It's certainly been used in patients who are post-chemotherapy, so I don't think prior exposure to chemotherapy is an automatic exclusion. It's really more the prognosis and the ability of the patient to complete therapy and have a healthy immune system long enough to develop an immune response and benefit.
So I see you had a paper last summer in the journal Urology, Quality of Life After Cipuleucel T Therapy. First, congratulations on your bravery in doing a quality of life study. I'm really curious what that was like, what you saw there. You know, such an important issue, and yet so often I read these papers and I can't figure out, you know, what does it really mean? What did you look at there, and what do you think it meant?
Yeah, so this paper is relatively limited in its applicability to real patient care decisions, but it provides one piece of information, and that is really a patient-based assessment of adverse effects. And the reason for that is that we looked at quality of life in a study of Cipuleucel T where it was used earlier than indicated. This was a non-metastatic disease, rising PSA after surgery. It was the so-called P11 study. And here we were looking at effects of Cipuleucel T on PSA recurrence and PSA doubling time. So these were patients by definition who are asymptomatic from prostate cancer. They didn't have metastases. Their main symptom really was the worry about their rising PSA, and they may have had symptoms related to their prior prostatectomy, but there was no pain or weight loss or any of the other things that you expect with advanced disease. So it was kind of a clean look at what happens if you give CYP-T to asymptomatic patients, and it was gratifying to see that quality of life held up very well. There wasn't an adverse effect of SYPOLIS-LT on quality of life, which, you know, if you gave a hormonal agent or a chemotherapeutic agent, you'd expect some decrement in quality of life. In an asymptomatic, healthy man, the side effects of those treatments do take a bit of a toll. But that's about it. There was no ability for us to measure improvements in quality of life because this particular study started out with patients that were free of any symptoms, so we couldn't make them any better.
We were talking about combining the two hormones, but there was a question from the audience about the issue of combining SYPULUSIL-T with a hormone. And I see you actually had a case report of a patient who got SYP-T and enzalutamide.
Yeah, that was a unique and very interesting patient. This was one of our patients on the phase 1-2 study of enzalutamide who had a really outstanding response to enzalutamide, had a PSA that dropped to the undetectable range, and then began to rise. He had metastatic disease. We added SYPOLIS-LT and continued the enzalutamide, and his PSA went back down to an undetectable range and stayed down, and it's still down in that range as of today. It's been at least a couple of years. A pretty remarkable experience. We haven't replicated it. We haven't tried to replicate it. It's something you can generally do because, you know, these drugs are not typically reimbursed together. This was a clinical trial where the enzalutamide was provided and the CYP-T was standard of care. We have expressed an interest in doing a study like this and wondered whether or not there's some unique interaction between enzalutamide and CYP-T. We haven't quite gotten it together to do a study like that prospectively, but that case report's gotten a lot of attention, and I think it brings up the question as to whether we might be able to take advantage of some combination therapy here. I wouldn't clinically recommend it at this point on the basis of one case report, though.
Another question from the audience. What about the use of enzalutamide or abiraterone with liver mets? I guess we could just talk in general about the issue of visceral mets and hormone therapy. Is that an indication or a reason to think more about chemo?
I think that's a good question. Traditionally, we've certainly often made the assumption that visceral metastases equals more aggressive disease that needs chemotherapy. And it is true that visceral metastases are an adverse prognostic factor. In the Cougar 302 study, which studied abiraterone prior to chemotherapy, those patients were excluded from the study. So we don't have data on the effects of abiraterone in that setting. The PREVAIL trial did allow patients with visceral metastases, and between 11 and 12%, depending which arm you looked at, of the patients that participated in PREVAIL had visceral metastases. Those included both liver and lung. The overall measurable disease response rate in that study was 59%. That included visceral disease as well as nodal disease. And we're looking at the breakdown by visceral disease versus nodal disease. We're going to report those results at an upcoming meeting. But I can tell you that when we looked at the effect on progression-free survival, which we have data on, people with visceral disease clearly benefited from enzalutamide. The hazard ratio was close to the overall hazard ratio of the study. So even in patients with visceral disease, enzalutamide decreased the risk of progression by something like 71%. So that tells me that hormonal signaling is alive and well in visceral mets, and enzalutamide is an active agent in that setting. We are going to look at it more closely, break it down by lung and liver, and report that data in detail at one of the upcoming meetings as soon as we can. So I don't have that data handy yet, but the progression data clearly suggests that visceral disease may not necessarily equal the need for chemotherapy immediately.
What about the need for a quick response? And this comes up in a lot of points in oncology, in breast cancer. Sometimes people talk about using chemo before hormones in a patient who maybe lymphangitic disease, they need a response right away. In lung cancer, you know, there's this issue about using EGFR TKIs or chemotherapy first. What about that kind of situation in prostate cancer? Does chemo work faster?
I think probably not, but there's some things I know and some things I don't yet know. First of all, chemotherapy doesn't really work that fast in conventional prostate cancer. In small cell cancer, that's a different story. But adenocarcinoma of the prostate, you know, that makes PSA and is conventional, doesn't melt away with chemotherapy. In one of our early studies many years ago, we looked at this, and as many as a third of patients had an increasing PSA during the first 8 weeks before it started going down. And as a surrogate, you know, we didn't scan these people every 4 weeks, but we did get PSAs. So we don't see instant responses to chemo with this disease. I think that's important to note. When we look at the progression-free survival curves on PREVAIL, they separate at the first scan. So there's clearly an effect of progression between 8 and 12 weeks. And we didn't look any earlier by scans. I don't yet have the data on how quickly the responses that we saw occurred. We have, you know, response rate is collected cumulatively over the whole life of the study, and I haven't broken it down by how many of those responses occurred at the first measurement, second measurement, and so forth. But at least by PSA, the effects of enzalutamide are very, very quick. In the phase 1-2 study, you know, when we first started watching folks on the treatment, within a week or two, we were seeing PSAs go down remarkably. So I don't think there is necessarily a difference in favor of chemotherapy. There may even be a difference in favor of second-line hormonal therapy with these more potent agents. We need to look at that, and we'll get back to the community with some results as soon as we can.
Final question. Is there a transient elevation of PSA when you start enzalutamide? Should you dose reduce? Do you think dose escalation is helpful when the disease is progressing?
I think with regard to transient elevations, it depends a bit how closely you look. I think at the end of 1 month, it's unlikely, but that's speaking from experience and not from detailed data. If you look a week or two into therapy, I don't think there is a flare. But sometimes what we see is what I would call disease momentum. So if your PSA is going up like crazy, so to speak, you introduce a new therapy, you may see kind of a dome-like response where you've still got a little bit of momentum, the PSA is still going up but slowing down, peaks and starts going down. So I think if you look very, very closely, you're not going to see an instantaneous response. Dose escalation, I have no data on. We did look at higher doses in the phase 1 and 2 studies, so it is possible to give higher doses. I would be concerned about the risk of seizures. We did see those at the highest doses at 360. And of course, reimbursement. It's hard for me to imagine that wouldn't get in the way of higher doses.